So we can actually do this, well, basically today. The reason I like this episode is it's kind of cool. Oh, we published a science abstract, some bloggers picked up, and then it's on TV. Whoa, that's kind of weird. But also, these guys had no videos from our lab at this point. They only had the blog items that were written about it, and they actually did an amazingly good job of showing what these things look like with the current state of technology if you do brain decoding. Whoa, that's weird. I wonder what else is missing. It's kind of scary when the first slide you show in your talk has all missing PNGs. So I will just talk through this. Let's imagine, since we're talking about brain decoding, let's visualize three slides here. The first, this actually was a picture showing various ways brain decoding technology has been used. Oh, it's missing on mine, too. That's good to know. I don't know where that went. The first is EEG. There are a lot of efforts to use EEG to try to decode brain activity. Why? An EEG system's small, it's portable, it fits on your head. Right now, it's kind of a pain to use because there's a lot of electrodes. You've got to put goo in each electrode. But they've come up with a bunch of dry systems for doing EEG recording. In fact, you may have seen a game controller either by NeuroSky or Emotive that let you move a little ball in a tube of air. Soon, next year, there will be game controllers for your iPhone that let you play EEG-based games on your iPhone. And believe it or not, computer security researchers are already trying to figure out if you build a game for somebody's iPhone that allows them to play a game using EEG, can people steal information from your brain while you're playing the game? This is actually a legitimate security concern. So that's one whole avenue. And you can imagine if you wanted to build something, there's car companies trying to build EEG-aided cars. The military wants to build EEG into all the helmets for the soldiers to help them do object detection and threat detection in the field. And also, hopefully someday, of course, what the military wants, they want soldiers to be able to talk to each other telepathically so they don't have to make any noise. There's a whole bunch of EEG-based systems. EEG-based wheelchair controllers, those are going to be out soon. They kind of work, but you know, that's something you want to get right the first time. There's a whole bunch of systems for aiding patients who have comas. So there are several brain traumas or brain diseases that cause you to become locked in or unable to communicate with the world. You can have a stroke, which limits your motor actions, but you can still think, right? That would be bad. You have neurodegenerative diseases that cause you to essentially lose all peripheral nerve function, even though your mind is still active, so you eventually kind of can't communicate with the world, even though you can hear and see and think. And there are chronic vegetative state patients who haven't communicated with the world for years. They're sort of lying in a coma, but there are some indirect neurobiological indications that these people can actually, they're somewhat aware of their surroundings. Now, obviously, that's one of the worst things that could happen to you is if you're conscious and aware of the world, but you can't interact with the world. And in fact, there's a lot of indirect evidence that if you're one of these locked-in patients and you are in this situation for a long period of time, that essentially you start to float away from reality. And the idea, this is just a theory, but the idea is that normally we use our interactions with the world to calibrate our brain. So if I want to pick up this cup, I reach over, I pick up the cup. And my brain learns whether it's doing it correctly, and if it's doing it poorly, I have a bunch of feedback systems in my brain that adapt and cause me to correctly pick up the cup. And if I do it correctly, then my brain's happy. But in these locked-in patients, what the theory is, what happens is, since they have no feedback loop anymore, they essentially lose touch with the world, and they kind of float off because there's no difference in how their brain influences the world between dreaming states and conscious states. So obviously, we would like to help these patients a lot because this is a really terrible thing to have happening.
Cognitive pattern.
It would be nice if we could come up with some decoding method for doing this. All right, so the rest of the talk's divided into these five or six parts, and I'll just go through each one so you kind of know what I'm talking about. Initially, let's just talk about the brain. This is my own particular pared-down view of the brain that just lists what's important. So we got a brain, and brains come in this sort of pinkish, gray after they're fixed. And these colored things are obviously not there to begin with. They were added later by me. This is just to show the large subsystems in the brain. Here we have the primary visual cortex in the back, the visual system back here, auditory here, motor system here, and somatosensory, and I can't remember what this part is. Is that, anybody know? Language? Is that language? This is some part that I don't care about. So it's this blue part up here. And then there's all these front parts that, you know, they're just all this abstract stuff, planning, thinking morality, thinking about what you're going to do next year. And this is mostly just shmoo at this point. You know, people have a vague idea of what's there, but it's pretty bad. Now, these are, of course, big subsystems. Each one of these subsystems is divided into a lot of individual areas. In fact, there are somewhere, nobody's quite sure, maybe between 200 and 500 distinct modules or areas in your brain. And of those, about a third of them are vision. So you figure there's something between, say, 50, 75 visual areas. Now, the brain in its normal state, enclosed in a shell and crunched up so that it fits inside your head, is very inconvenient to work with. So if you're a neuroanatomist of my school, you realize the first thing you want to do is get the brain out of the head and flatten it out so you can look at it. And so we can do that computationally. We take an MRI anatomical image, we extract the anatomical image from the MRI data, and then we computationally find the surface of gray matter, and we essentially inflate it. So now we've got like a brain-shaped beach ball, and then we put some cuts in it, and we flatten it out. So now we've got a brain-shaped pizza. Now, I don't know why everybody doesn't... What the heck? It's just one of those days. No, my computer is just trying to save power. Hang on a second. My apologies. All right. So when you do this, you end up, if you're a human, and we flatten out your brain, you end up with something about the size of a large pizza. And you can think of the individual systems and areas as being essentially the toppings on the pizza. They're distributed across the surface of the pizza. Right. So here I've drawn in outline form a lot of the areas we know about in the parts of the brain that I'm interested in. So all this is the back of the brain here, posterior. This is anterior. This is dorsal. And this is ventral. So the visual areas are here at the back. These are the retinotopic areas, primary visual cortex, area V1, V2, V3, V4. Then there's a bunch of these functionally localized areas. They're not retinotopically organized, but they're specialized for processing a certain semantic category, like the parahippocampal place area you either have or will hear about that appears to be specialized for processing places, the fusiform face area for processing faces, the extrastriate body area, the transverse occipital sulcus, the inferior parietal sulcus, various things. RSC is another place area. Then there's auditory cortex down here. There's a motor system, the somatosensory system here. The temporoparietal junction you'll probably hear about in this course, that's actually about right here. And this is the mystery meat up here at the front that I ignore. All right. So there's a bunch of areas. There's a bunch of parts we know about, and there's a bunch of parts we don't know about. You can see in the back of the brain here, this is all, we've tiled our pizza with areas, right? We've divided this into little areas that are denoted with white lines, and they're given a name. That means we know something about them. And then there's a bunch of other stuff, like what is this stuff in here? All this is blank. Well, it's here between the retinotopic areas and PPA and FFA, so it must be vision, but nobody knows what it is. It's just mystery meat. It's slightly less mysterious than the stuff at the front, because we know it's vision, but other than that, we don't know what it does. So you can think of one of the jobs, one of the important jobs of cognitive neuroscience, as essentially trying to enumerate all of the various toppings on this pizza and what they do. Okay. Now, one thing I should mention is that these areas are very highly interconnected. Now, we don't really have this information for humans, but this is the brain of a macaque monkey. So here's the side view and the medial view, and here's the flattened view of the macaque. And in this case, instead of making a split down V1, they've sort of taken V1 off and flattened it out separately. And you can see that the macaque, unlike humans, is, it's also highly visual, but it's about 50% visual rather than a third visual. And over here is a wiring diagram that shows us how these various visual areas are connected together. Now, when this slide was made, these people knew about 32 individual areas, visual areas in the monkey, and they're laid out here. And if you have 32 areas, and every area was connected with every other area, you would have 900 connections. In fact, there's about 300 connections. So this network is one-third interconnected. And it's organized both hierarchically and in parallel. So information comes in at the eyeball, it goes to LGN, it goes to V1, then it goes to V2, then it gets divided up into several streams, a ventral stream that runs down the side of your head and is important for object recognition, and a dorsal stream that runs up the back of your head to parietal cortex, and these are called the what and where streams, but it's not good to think of the parietal system as the where stream. It's better to think of it as the coordinate transformation stream. So if I look at this cup, and I need to pick up this cup, where this cup is projecting onto my retina is completely irrelevant to me picking it up. What I need to do is I need to translate where this cup projects onto my retina to the pulley commands I need to make my arm go over and pick this cup up, right? And so I need to take into account where the retina, where my eye is in my head, where my head is relative to my shoulders, where my arm is, and how much this cup weighs. All those factors have to be brought into bear in order for me to pick up this cup. And that kind of job is mainly done in the parietal stream. So there's a lot of visual areas. As I said, there's 50 or 60, 75 visual areas. And of these, right now, we only have good models of two of them, our primary visual cortex and this other little weird area called MT, which both we have and monkeys have. So now let's talk about two things. First of all, methods for recording brain activity, and then methods for decoding brain activity, how we're going to actually try to do decoding. And let's talk about them separately. You may have seen this slide because Rich said he had talked about methods a lot. So you may have seen some version of this slide. This tells you about the spatial and temporal resolution of various brain activity measurement methods. On the horizontal axis here, we have temporal resolution from 1 millisecond to 10 seconds on a log scale. On the vertical axis, we have spatial resolution from 1 micron to 10 centimeters on a log scale. The gray things here are just the various scales of organization of the brain, from synapses to single neurons to columns to areas. The green things are the invasive methods, which we don't want to use with humans if we can help it. And the red things are the non-invasive methods. And the size here is essentially tells you about the quality of the data you get from these various methods. And you can see that there's two really good quality methods. Neurophysiology, which is single unit recording, which gives you great data about one neuron out of the 10 to the 12th neurons in the brain. And fMRI, which actually doesn't measure neurons at all, but gives you fairly decent coverage of the entire brain. So since this is a talk about human encoding and decoding, let's focus on fMRI for the rest of the talk. This is an MRI machine. You guys may have seen a picture of an MRI machine before. You see them all the time. This actually happens to be a head-only machine, unlike ours. Basically, an MRI machine is a big gigantic magnet. And you put people inside this magnet. It's thousands of times stronger than the Earth's magnetic field. And it aligns some really tiny fraction of the protons in your body along the main magnetic field. And then you essentially have their head in a bucket, as you see here. This bucket is a send-receive coil that puts in essentially some radio frequency energy. It's kind of like an inverse TV antenna. And then it reads the radio wave frequency energy that your brain gives off. And that's really all you want to know about how MRI works. What you do need to know about MRI is that it does not measure neurons. And most of the papers you will see that use fMRI as their technology talk about measuring neural activity. And all the people that say that are lying, and you should make fun of them, because it does not measure neural activity. It measures blood flow. It actually measures a complicated interaction between changes in oxygen use, changes in blood volume, and changes in blood flow. What essentially happens is a neuron fires. There are little glia that pick up the extra neurotransmitter so it doesn't hang around in the synaptic cleft. Those glia have little filipodia on the capillaries, and they open their filipodia when they detect some neuron somewhere nearby has fired. And this way, the neurons that are firing get extra oxygen and sugar from the bloodstream. They need to essentially burn sugar with oxygen in order to make ATP, in order to have energy to fire. So there's an indirect coupling between neurons firing and blood flow. But remember, we're measuring from these veins in the head. We're not going to measure in MRI the brain. We're going to measure the plumbing of the brain. And the signal-to-noise is going to be kind of low because we're not measuring where the neurons actually are. The plumbing and the neuron can't be at the same place. The neuron's here. The plumbing must be next door. So we're always going to be offset somewhat from the brain. And we're going to measure things in blood vessels that are about the same size as the voxels. So in a typical MRI experiment, MRI divides the brain up into a bunch of little cubes. These thousands and thousands, 100,000 little cubes are about the size of a pea, and the cubes are called voxels, volumetric pixels, voxels. And we're going to be measuring MRI signals from veins whose size is about the same size as the voxels. And if we're recording from a part of the brain where there's no vein about that size, then we're not going to get an MRI signal. So our MRI signal is going to be spotty. This size of an MRI signal is about 2 millimeters, which is about the size of a hypercolumn in primary visual cortex. I don't know if you guys have seen this ice cube model. This is a standard model of visual cortex in V1. These are orientation columns. These are ocular dominance columns. And you can see that when we measure a single voxel in MRI, we're going to be measuring over a whole bunch of orientation columns. So we're not going to be able to pull off the individual variables that are measured at each point in the brain, orientation and spatial frequency. We're only going to be able to pull off variables that are organized according to a larger scale than an individual cortical column. And because we're measuring the plumbing here rather than neurons, it's really slow. A neuron can fire 100, 200 times a second, but the signal that changes the capillaries, the plumbing signal, actually is much slower. As you can see here, this is a retinotopic map, and what we've done here is stimulated all these locations in the visual field with checkerboards, and the colors here correspond to the colors of these bars. You can see that when we stimulate this yellow, green, or red place, we get an increase in bold, but the increase in bold takes about 4 seconds to materialize. So bold is blood oxygen level dependent response. That's what we actually measure in MRI. So this is much, much, much slower than neurons. Neuron, 100 or 200 times a second. Blood flow signals, 4 seconds later. Way slower. For this reason, people have always assumed it was impossible to do anything cool and dynamic with MRI. That basically, if you used MRI, you were going to be stuck measuring slow things because MRI is slow. So if you wanted to look at, say, how people code faces, you wouldn't show faces in movies because those are changing really fast. What you would do in an MRI experiment is you'd show a face for, say, 10 seconds, and then you'd show a building for 10 seconds, and you'd just subtract the two. And what I'll be talking about today is a method for getting around this problem, for essentially trying to extract really fast things that happen from these really slow blood flow signals. So now let's talk about the problem of decoding. We've got some brain activity, and now we want to decode it from the brain. Okay. How are we going to do that? Well, first, let's look at what we have. On the left here is a movie that we showed subjects in the magnet, and on the right here is a flat map. This is the flattened pizza map of a person's brain. On the medial here, in the middle of the slide, is the posterior axis. So this is the visual system back here. This is the frontal cortex up here. Again, this is dorsal, so this is parietal cortex. This is the auditory cortex down here. And here I'm making a map of brain activity. So remember, this is brain activity measured by fMRI. So it's changes in blood flow and blood volume. And gray here means the average blood flow and blood oxygen use. Red means more blood oxygen use, and blue means less. And in this particular experiment, we were taking frames, whole brain images, every 2 seconds. So we simply linearly interpolated every 2 seconds to make the changes over time more obvious. So this is the world. This is the brain responding to the world. Now we want to understand what the brain's doing. Well, what does that really mean? What it means is we want to figure out what in the world here is making these little changes in color. And obviously, the brain's a complicated place. It consists of hundreds of modules, so you're not just going to have one model that works for the whole brain. What you need to do is you need to try to come up with some way to describe the relationship between the world here and each point on the surface of this pizza. And if we remove cortex and flatten it out at the typical resolutions we use in an MRI experiment, we're going to have about 30,000 individual points in this map. So what we want to do is we want to build 30,000 models that describe the relationship between stuff that's happening out here and these changes in brain activity that we can record. And if we can do that, then we can say we understand the brain in this sense of understanding the mapping between the world and the brain. Right? I should mention, because I know you guys have been watching this, most of the changes are here back in the visual system. As you'd expect, these are movies. But you do see a lot of other changes up here in sort of more mysterious parts of the brain as well. Right? OK, so really, this is a problem of building a dictionary. We want a translation dictionary, a world-brain translation dictionary. And since we have a bunch of points in the brain and they all do different things, building one dictionary would be really, really huge and probably impossible. So we're going to build a bunch of dictionaries. For each point in the brain, we're going to build a separate dictionary, a world brain translation dictionary. And how are we going to know if that dictionary is right? Well, it's simple. We put somebody in a magnet for a couple hours, we show them a movie. We build a dictionary. Now, we put them back in the magnet, we show them a different movie that they hadn't seen before. And we measure some brain activity. And we take that same movie, we shove it through the dictionary, and we make some predicted brain activity, and we just compare them. Is the observed brain activity the same as the predicted brain activity? If it is, then our dictionary is right. So we can actually make a dictionary for every point in the brain, and we can figure out by doing prediction which points in the brain the dictionary is correct for and which points it isn't correct for. And then we can take the places that the dictionary is lousy, and we can try to build a different dictionary. Of course, trying to build a different dictionary is a hard problem, but if this was all easy, then it would have already been solved. So there you go. All right. So there are multiple ways to try to build these dictionaries. Some of them involve actually explicitly building a dictionary, and some of them involve a sort of more implicit kind of method. The most common method, actually, for trying to build a brain decoder has nothing to do with building an explicit dictionary. It's called building a classifier. And that works as described in this slide. So this is a paper from Frank Tong and Yuri? I'm forgetting Kamatani's first name. Anyway, he's Japanese, not Russian, so it can't be Yuri. Yukeli? Anyway, all right. So we've got an oriented grading here. And all we're going to try to do is decode grading orientation. So the person fixates on the spot here, and we show them a grading. And this grading could be oriented to the right, oriented to the left on different trials. And we're going to try to decode whether the grading is oriented to the right or oriented to the left. And to do this, we're not going to build a dictionary. We're going to try to build a classifier. So we take the individual voxels that we recorded in the brain. And for each individual, for each voxel, essentially, you can imagine that the individual voxels aren't going to all respond exactly the same to this oriented grading. Some of them are going to slightly prefer the right-hand grading, and some of them are going to slightly prefer the left-hand grading. And so we can essentially find a weighted sum of voxels that maximally discriminates between right-hand gradings and left-hand gradings, and that thing is called a classifier because it classifies right-hand gradings versus left-hand gradings. And obviously, if we're on a part of the brain that's non-visual, then when we try to take a weighted sum of the voxels that discriminates orientation, it's going to do a lousy job. And if we're part of the brain that's visual, the classifier is going to do a decent job. And here you can see that we've got all of our individual voxels. You can look at the tuning curves. Here's an individual voxel, and this voxel has this tuning curve for different orientations. So these are the bold responses on the vertical axis and the orientations on the x-axis. And this is a different voxel. You can see each one of these has different tuning curves for orientation. And when you sum all these together, you can essentially get a 45-degree detector. This is the response to 45-degree gradings, and this is the response to 135-degree gradings. So you can decode orientation. Now, this kind of decoding is by far the most popular kind of decoding that people use, not only in neuroscience, but actually also in computer vision. If you go to Ford and they say, oh, you can buy our new pedestrian detector to put in your car so that if a pedestrian's out there, it'll tell you there's a pedestrian, slow down, or it'll apply the brakes for you. That thing actually is just a classifier. It classifies pedestrians from everything else. Classifiers are hugely important in electronic technology, computer vision, and in brain decoding. But as far as brain decoding goes, they actually have some problems, some really important fundamental problems. And the one that I think is most kind of relevant for neuroscience is this. Imagine I build a brain decoder. Imagine I build a brain decoder, say, to decode faces. All right. So I'm going to show you a bunch of faces. I'm going to use a classifier to try to classify whether the thing I showed you was a face or a non-face. Straightforward problem. All I need to do is take the faces and the non-faces and find a weighted sum of all the voxels that maximally discriminate between faces and non-faces. Okay. Now I show you some new stimuli. Some of them are faces, some of them aren't. And I check how well my decoder works. Now, say my decoder works 20%, 20% accurate decoding faces. Okay, as a neuroscientist, the question is, should I be happy? And the answer is, I have no idea. I have no idea if that's a good number or not. And the reason is simple. Imagine that I'm actually recording these voxels from a part of the brain that almost knows nothing about faces. It's basically doing as good as it can do, given that it doesn't give a damn about faces. Say it's the motor system, right? What does the motor system know about faces? 20% from the motor system is pretty good. So in that case, I might actually be decoding almost all the available information in that part of the brain. And 20% would be good because there's just no other information in there to get. So I should be happy. But now imagine that I actually built this decoder on, say, FFA, the fusiform face area, where the common view is that the whole point of this module in the brain is to detect faces. Now, if I build my decoder and I'm only getting 20% correct, in theory, FFA should be able to do really well, maybe 90% correct. But my model is only doing 25% correct, or 20% correct. Why? Well, maybe I screwed up something on my computer. Maybe there was a lot of noise in my brain activity measurements. Maybe my subjects moved a lot, so their MRI data were really, really lousy. Maybe I just don't know what I'm doing. There are a lot of ways I can make my decoder go from its theoretical point, 90%, down to 20%, and be doing horribly. And the problem is, if all you do is build a decoder, you actually don't know which one of these situations you're in, and actually it's impossible to know which one of these situations you're in if you only have decoding data. So the problem with building these decoders, only a decoder based on a classifier, is you get some result, and unless it's 100%, you never know if you're happy. You never know if your job is done. Because remember, decoding is just an engineering job. Our job as scientists is to figure out how the damn brain works. Just getting a number, 20%, you know, in this case, you could say, I know how the brain works, but in this case, you don't know anything about how the brain works. So you don't know if your job's done as a scientist. So I don't like classifiers, and I complain about them constantly, and I annoy all my friends, most of whom build classifiers. All right, so I'm going to show you a different way to do brain decoding that involves encoding models, which I think is the much better way to go. So to motivate this, let's start with an MRI experiment. This is the dumbest MRI experiment you can possibly imagine. We show some movies to people, and we have them lie in the magnet, and we record their brain activity. The experiment doesn't get any simpler than that, right? I mean, what do? They fixate on a spot. I didn't draw the spot here. Basically, they just fixate on the spot. This takes about 3 hours, but they don't do this all at once. They do this over several days, and they have to fixate really, really well and not move their heads, and you want people to stay awake and attentive. So to try to keep them to being attentive, we actually showed them Hollywood movie trailers rather than just random movies, because we figure Hollywood's trying to keep your attention, you know, before the movie starts in the theater. They're trying to keep your attention and draw you away from the popcorn and Coke to pay attention to the movie trailer. So we figured that would work. And then in order to make sure they stayed awake in the magnet, we used the most desperate, motivated people we could find who were our co-authors on the paper, the graduate students in the lab. So they spent hours and hours in the magnet. And all this stuff is MRI magic. You don't need to know about that. Oh, and we showed two sets of movies here. We showed 12 10-minute movies, one repetition each, and we did this to try to build the model. And then we showed one 9-minute movie for 10 reps each, and we used this to test predictions. So now what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to use these data to build dictionaries. We're going to try to use them to build dictionaries for each point in the brain. So I mentioned earlier there's going to be about 30,000 dictionaries we're going to build. And the problem is we don't know what these dictionaries should be in advance, right? We've got some brain data. We've got basically a list of movies and a list of brain activity data, and we need to build a model that links these two. How do we really do that? Well, we don't know what model to pick. So the nice thing about this kind of problem is it's kind of an inductive problem rather than a deductive problem. We can just data mine and build our models. And what we do is we build multiple models for each point in the brain. So initially we have our data. This is, you can think of it as, I should mention our brain activity measurements in this experiment were taken every 1 second. So essentially we don't have information about the individual frames of the movie. What we've got is essentially a brain activity that reflects everything that happened in the movie for that 1 second. So the stimulus, instead of being a frame of a movie, it's essentially a little block, a little cube of space-time. It's got X, Y, and T. And now we've got a bunch of voxels, 30,000 voxels in the brain. So we're trying to build a model using regression that links this to this. And then once we build that model, we're going to try to predict responses using that model on our held-out data set. So to build models, one thing we can do is we can, say, take our stimulus, and we can nonlinearly transform it into some new space that reflects the kind of dictionary we think is actually relevant for that part of the brain. So if we're recording from a part of the brain that we think is interested in edges and little local motions and little texture, then we can make essentially an edge model. We can take our stimulus, make an edge model, and then fit this edge model to the voxels. And then we're going to get essentially a weighted sum of weights on these edges for each voxel. Essentially, so each voxel is going to have a set of weights for each of these little discretized locations in this cube of space-time. And it's going to tell us how much this voxel cares about an edge occurring at that location. And then we can take a different model, say here we go from our stimulus in space-time to a region model. So this model doesn't know about the edges, but it knows there's some blobs here, and all three of these blobs are of the same kind, and there's some other blob here on the bottom, and this is of the same kind. And now I can essentially discretize this transformed stimulus and fit it to my voxels, and I get a set of weights, which tell me how much each voxel cares about each of the points in this little cube of space-time in this transformed region space. Or we could do something more abstract. We could say take labels. Okay, now I'm gonna take this movie, I'm gonna extract the labels, so there's steer, steer, sky, steer, grass. And now I'm going to treat these labels as the things I'm going to regress in my regression model. I'm going to find the relationship between voxels and labels. I'm going to build each of these three models for every point in the brain, and we're just going to test each model's predictions to see which one works best. Now, in early visual cortex, primary visual cortex, we actually have an advantage because neuroscientists have spent 50 years figuring out how area V1 works. And we have a lot of data, neurophysiological data, MRI data, brain lesion data from people who've had strokes, and computational modeling data to tell us what kind of model we need to build for early visual cortex. And this is the kind of model. This is called a Gabor wavelet pyramid. Basically, your brain represents images like this in terms of a collection of neurons that have receptive fields that look like this. Essentially, your brain decomposes every natural image into a bunch of little localized features that have a certain orientation, a certain location, and a certain spatial frequency or scale. And it turns out that any natural image can be broken down into a set of, I should mention, this is just more and more basis functions. So here's the image represented by all the little weighted Gabor functions you need. Here's a subset of the Gabor functions. Here's an even smaller subset of the Gabor functions. This is an even smaller subset of the Gabor functions. So all he's done here is he's taken the highest amplitude Gabor functions from this image and plotted them here. This is just to show you that you can synthetically, by adding more and more of these weird patches, these don't look like natural images, but by adding more and more of these patches together, you can make an image. And in fact, you can make any natural image out of these patches. And in fact, you can make a movie out of these patches if they move. And this turns out to be the most efficient way to represent movies. And it's the way that JPEG represents movies, more or less. JPEG does some simplifying things. And MPEG. And it's also the code that is used in your primary visual cortex. So we want to build a model of primary visual cortex. We essentially want to have that model consist of thousands and thousands of these little receptive fields or basis functions. So we can build a model like this. Let's try to build a model for area V1. So we start with our movies. And remember, the only data we have is we've got some movies and we've got some brain activity. And we want to link the two. Now, we've got a problem because we know that we measure plumbing. We didn't measure neurons. So what we'd like to do is break this problem into two parts. A neural part, which is essentially going to be a model of something we never saw, which is the underlying neural population, and a blood flow part, which gives us the linkage between the neurons that we didn't measure, our latent variables, and the observed variables that we did measure, the blood flow. So to do that, we first take our movie and we pass it through a bank of little spatiotemporal Gabor filters. Each one, we throw away color because it doesn't help us. We have a spatiotemporal filter. We do some nonlinear magic with them that you don't need to know about. And then we temporally downsample from the frame rate of the movie, which is 15 hertz, to the frame rate of our brain activity measurements, which is 1 hertz. Now, this is actually a bank of filters. So we're going to take our movie. We're going to pass it through a bank of these filters. There's going to be something like 2,000 to 8,000 of these filters, and they're going to tile all possible locations in the visual field and all possible orientations and all possible motion speeds. Now, for each one of these filters, we actually fit this is called a hemodynamic response filter or a hemodynamic coupling term. Really, it's a term that describes the relationship between this filter's output and the bold responses that we measure. And so this is going to be a big fitting problem because these filters live in time. There's going to be about 6 parameters we're going to fit to each one of these. There's between 2,000 and 8,000 of them. We're going to try to do this with bold data. So you have to be good at fitting. And you can see that this is a big statistics problem and a big applied math regression problem that is nothing anybody in this room cares about. But unfortunately, it's what my lab spends about half our time doing because we never have enough data to really fit these models. So we're always dancing at the edge of what you can fit. Now, when you want to check one of these models, there's a really simple thing you can do, which is to do a game we call image identification, or the card trick. So imagine that I give you a deck of cards, and I tell you to go in the magnet and pull a card out of the deck and stare at it, and then come back and put the card in the middle of the deck. I can't see what card you picked. Now I look at your brain activity, and I have to use the model I built of your brain to try to predict which card you saw. Now, we've done that before with static images. In this case, we did it with movies. So we built a model of people's brains to process movies using early vision, primary visual cortex. We showed them 400 seconds of movies in the magnet, and now we have to try to identify which second they saw and using just their brain activity, and that's up here in the vertical axis. And you can see that we're 97, 98% correct on this? And now we can increase the number of movies in the card deck, in the deck of cards, up to above 10 to the 6, which is a million images. And you can see even when there's a million potential seconds of movie they could have saw, we can get basically 80% correct on which movie they saw. So this tells us that even though we're measuring the plumbing rather than neurons, when we build this forward model of primary visual cortex and then use it to try to identify which movie you saw, we're amazingly accurate. There's a huge amount of information in these data. And that tells us that we should be able to do good decoding. Because if we can do good encoding, we can predict accurately. Now we can invert the model and do decoding. And I'll talk about that in just a minute after I talk about one more kind of model. Oh, this just shows you the model of one voxel. It's pretty complicated. There's thousands of orientations and spatial frequencies and phases and positions that this voxel cares about. Because a voxel, remember, one little tiny voxel that you record in MRI is encompasses somewhere between 200,000 to a million neurons. So there's a lot of neurons underneath here. Skip this. All right. Now, I showed you a model for the early visual system, but you can also build a model of the higher visual system. Wow, is it really 1150? Is it really 1150? All right. So let's build a model for the higher visual system really quickly. In this case, there are parts of the brain that care about semantic categories, like faces and places and cars and all kinds of things. There's thousands of semantic categories that you potentially could care about. So to build a model for this, what we did is we went through the images and we extracted all the objects and actions in each, sorry, the movies. We extracted all the objects and actions in each movie, and we coded them according to this thing called WordNet. WordNet is just a hierarchy of the is-a relationships between every noun and the is-a relationships between every verb. And there's millions of nouns and verbs in WordNet. We just use the 1,700 most common nouns and verbs. So now we can go through the movie, and each second we can say, was there a dog? Was there a canine? Was there a cat? And then we can use our same fitting algorithm to say, well, if there was a dog in the clip, let's fit a hemodynamic response function that links whether there was a dog in the clip to the voxel activity, and then we can take a sum of those to predict our voxel. So we're essentially trying to find the weighted sum of semantic features that optimally describes the activity in each voxel. And this shows you the tuning curve for one voxel. Here, this is the semantic tree for this voxel. This is 1,700 nouns and verbs. This is a tree, remember, so you can see that this is a tree because there are these little links. Each one of these nodes is one noun or verb. I've only put labels on a few of them so you can see what they are. And the blue things are nouns and verbs that tend to decrease brain activity, and the red things are nouns and verbs that tend to increase brain activity. You can see that this voxel, which is in fusiform face area, it likes animals and people and athletes and anything with a face, and it likes carnivores and rodents and mammals. Basically, it likes also talking verbs, communicating and talking and things like that. So if it's got a face or it's a face doing something facey, this voxel likes it. Okay. Here's a PPA voxel, parahippocampal place area. You can see that this voxel does not respond when there's a face. Instead, it responds to all these kinds of vehicle-y kind of things. It responds to indoor scenes, outdoor scenes, structures, buildings, clothing, artifacts, containers, furniture, boats, vehicles, wheeled vehicles, balls, kettles, chairs, all kinds of stuff. It's if it's an inanimate object that tends to occur in a place, this voxel likes it. Now, you can do this for all the voxels in the head, and you can basically find this just shows you how your brain encodes objects. So I'm not really going to tell you how we did this. Essentially, think of it this way. I've taken the 1,700 semantic categories here, and I've taken the entire brain, and I'm looking at the similarity in how the brain encodes these 1,700 semantic categories. So things with similar colors are encoded similarly by the brain. You can see the brain tends to encode people and children and adults all kind of the same. And it kind of encodes them similarly to communication verbs. It encodes birds and fish and all kinds of animals the same. It encodes vehicles kind of the same. It encodes places the same, and also furniture and things that occur in places. You can get a lot of information about this, none of which I'm going to talk about today because it's an hour-long talk, and we're not talking about that. We're talking about decoding. Oh, you can also look and see how these things are distributed across the brain. So here's just four categories: vehicles, buildings, people, and animals. And I've colored the brain according to where these categories are represented. And you can see that these four categories are represented a lot of places all over the brain. So remember earlier we talked about missing pieces in this vision pizza where there are pieces that just don't have any information. We can actually recover information about a lot of semantic tuning from this technique. So now let's talk about decoding. Decoding, once you have an encoding model, turns out to be completely trivial. Here we have our encoding model. We've got a stimulus. We nonlinearly map it into some feature space. This feature space is our dictionary. This could be an edge dictionary with little local features, or it could be a semantic category dictionary. And then we linearly fit that to our bold data. When we do decoding, we take our bold responses, we aggregate over the bold responses, we linearly map them back into the dictionary, and then we somehow or other try to transform the dictionary back into the stimulus. And for those of you who know Bayes' theorem, it turns out to be just this equation. Here's the probability of response given a stimulus. This is our model. We have some prior on the stimulus. We multiply these together, and we get the posterior, which is the probability of a stimulus given a response. And if we take the peak of this posterior, that's our most likely decoded thing. That's our reconstruction of what you saw. Now remember, when we do this, we are not using the stimuli at all, only the brain activity. So we're going to try to decode without any information about what the person saw. So this is just some examples of decoding. Here we have three images we showed somebody in the magnet. And here's our decoded results. Here we have a beach scene or a harbor scene. Here's a harbor scene. Here's a bunch of people in a room. Here's a bunch of people in a room with their hands up. Here's two buildings in the front, one in the back. Here's two buildings in the front, one in the back. You notice the contrast is wrong. Here we go from white to black. This is because we lose the sign of contrast when we translate from neurons, which know about contrast, to blood flow, which actually doesn't know whether you're talking about positive contrast neurons or negative contrast neurons. Here's imagery. You might say, well, if you can decode images, how can you decode imagery? So Tom Nasilaris, the guy that did this experiment, he spent a week trying to memorize these four images, and then he went in the magnet, and a little cue would come up, like it would say the word Mona Lisa, and he would try to image a picture of the Mona Lisa in his mind. I think it's kind of cool that we get Soma Hayek as the decode result. Then it said soldier, so he imagines this. We get kind of this soldiery jockey person. Here it was like kitty cat. I think that's a kitty cat. And this is a doggy. And here we have vegetables, so he images vegetables, we get vegetables. So this decoder works even for visual memory, although way not as well, not as good as if you have an actual image. Why? Well, okay, something in your brain is probably the same when you do visual imagery and when you look at the world. But they can't be exactly the same, because if they were, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between wandering around the world and dreaming, right? They would look the same to you, and they obviously don't. So to the extent that a model that we build based on the world maps to a model of how your brain operates during visual imagery, then this will work. To the extent that your brain's doing something else during visual imagery, this won't work. This is a place model. So in this case, remember, the model doesn't know anything about where things occurred, but you can ask it where things occurred. It doesn't have any information about the images, but you can ask it where things occurred in the image. So here, you show somebody this image, and then you ask the model, where are the animals? And it says, I think there was an animal here. Or where are the man-made objects? So I think there's some man-made objects here. Where are the people? It's just drawing the pink squares. It doesn't have the pictures. I think there's some people here. And where are the plants? And it says, I think there's a plant here. So this is extracting both semantic and spatial information from your brain. This is kind of cool because it's a category model. It's actually built using a machine learning algorithm. So this decodes both. This model represents, I don't want to go into it. This decodes the scenes that it thinks you saw and the objects in the scenes. So here we've got this bizarre thing. It says, well, I think this is maybe a land animal scene or a few people scene. And that means there's probably some man, a woman, a person, a head, an animal. Here it says, I think this is a sporting event and some large crowds. And I think there's going to be some athletes and some people in there. Here it says, I think you saw a sign and some text. And that means it's got a sign and some text. You can see that in all these cases, it's the model does a really good job. So again, just extracted from your brain activity with no information about the images. Now, this is the thing that we showed on YouTube that was so popular, although we only had these two panels. This is a motion model, so it's decoding motion and static images. It's essentially decoding local moving features, little local oriented edges occurring at different places in the visual scene. It doesn't know anything about what the object is. And here we have the movie and our reconstruction, and the two different reconstructions, actually, something called the average reconstruction, the peak reconstruction. So let me take 1 minute and explain this. You can't reconstruct directly to the pixels. If you do, you're going to get something that's crappy. So you need to give the brain activity measurements are so bad, you need to give the algorithm some hints. So what you do is you go up, we went out to YouTube, and we started a random downloading process that just randomly downloaded 18 million seconds, 5,000 hours, of random YouTube video. Now we've got your brain activity data and these random YouTube videos that we did not show you. And we're going to try to reconstruct what you saw using these random YouTube videos. The way we do that is we shove them through the model, we make a predicted brain activity for each YouTube video, and we combine the YouTube videos together to make predicted brain activity that looks as much as we can like the brain activity we actually saw, and then we show that. That's our reconstruction. You can think of it as we're painting a movie of what you saw, but instead of paint, our palette consists of 18 million YouTube videos, and we have to find the right combination of YouTube videos to paint on the screen to make what you saw. And you can see that it works pretty well, especially when what's in the scene is a person. When the scene's a person, you can tell that this is a person. It works pretty well. When the scene is something really abstract, like this thing, there's nothing in YouTube that looks anything like this, so our reconstruction is pretty lousy. Like this elephant. There's nothing in our 18 million seconds, there's no elephants. So you just get this shambling mound. It does a lousy job of reconstructing. Okay. Now, this is the low-level part of the brain. The last cool thing I'd like to show you is the high-level part of the brain. What if we try to decode the semantic part of the brain? Well, we can do that too. So now we've got our, again, movie, and we're going to decode the likely objects and actions. And because there's going to be multiple things occurring, I'm going to arrange them by slow, fast, and not human, human. And you can see that this decoder also works pretty well. Okay, I know there's a man. I know there's a shirt. He's talking. He's wearing something. There's no one. Fine. Well, dog. Wait, that seems like a mistake. Oh, wait, there's a dog. Okay, so I'm just a little off on the timing on my decoder. Man, woman, shirt, talking. There's no girl and woman. It's not perfect. Okay, this says jamboree for some reason. Who the heck knows why? That's, here we go. Mountain view, rocks, clouds, fog. That's pretty good. This thing actually kind of screws up. It doesn't get buildings, but it knows highness. It has highness twice, green, large, sky. It's like, oh, I don't know what's going on. Everything except the building. Well, how could it screw that up? Okay. Then we get women, and so we get talking, talked, woman, man, looking, bird. There's no bird shirt. There's some kind of birdie-like things up here. Flower gets that. That's all pretty good. Flower pink. And then you notice we change the ocean. All of a sudden, swimming, fish, shark, flower, fish, ocean, whale. This thing works pretty damn well. You can imagine if you build a decoder that combined the low-level activity with the high-level activity, so you constrained your YouTube videos so they not only had the right structure, but they contained the right objects, you could do a really damn good job of decoding. So what is future directions? Well, there's three limitations to this. The quality of brain activity measurements, and these change all the time. The quality of the encoding models that we use, and computer power. And all three of these things change all the time. So in 10 or 20 years, I'll be dead by this time, but you won't. You'll still be here. Somebody's going to come up with a new method for measuring brain activity that's much, much, much better than what we have now. And they're going to be able to decode a lot more information than we can now. And then I think there's going to be ethical issues that are going to come up. When can you use this technology? When can you not use this technology? There's going to be informed consent issues. All of this stuff is going to have to be dealt with. We don't have to deal with this right now, but we have to start thinking about it, because anything that psychologists or neuroscientists learn about how the brain works, because that allows you to build a better encoding model, that will allow you to do better brain decoding. The two go hand in hand. Anyway, thanks a lot for your time.